called Six Keys and Five Poisons, which I guess means we're going to talk about 11 things. We're going to be studying Lojong by Gyalwa Yong Gompa. Say Gyalwa
Yong
Gompa. He lived 1213 to 1258, so not very long. He was of the Drukpa Kagyu lineage. I think probably he's the only Kagyu Lama in these Lojongs we're going to study. Kagyu has a lot of sub-schools, and many of them are centered around a particular lama that has taken a piece of their lineage and decided to make that his or her main study, and then that's what is their disciples follow too. But also, there are less what you might call personal lineages, and this is one of them, Drukpa, Drukpa Kagyu. We have a couple of other Kagyu lamas in our tantric lineage. But Kagyu's, Jeansol Kapa was a Kagyu. We normally think of him as Gelugpa, but his students started the Gelugpa school, Gelugpa sect. He didn't. So he was Kagyu. He had a close friend. They taught each other, who was Sakya. So they shared those lineages. It was very, very beautiful for that. So Gyalwa Yong Gunpa had one of his teachers was Sakya Pandita, who is very important in our tantric lineage. And there'll be more important things you learn about in a minute from him. Sakya Pandita was a very famous Sakya scholar, 1182 to 1251. And then Gyalwa Yong Gunpa was also a student of Tsongpa.
Tsongpa.
Yeah, 1189 to 1258. The kind of text we're going to study, there was a particular, I guess, genre, say Damak. Lojong. Damak is a set of personal advices given to a very small group of students. For example, you might be riding in a car with a few other students to Salzburg for a teaching or something, and your lama's with you. And during that car ride, you would get some teachings from him that were designed just by him, just for you, by him or her, just for you. That's a Damnak. That's a hard one to say, Damnak, Lojong. So, and this Lojong is called the Six Keys. I don't want that. There we go. So here we go. Don't do that. Why are these different? Whoa. I have no idea why these aren't on the slides. Anyway,
You're looking for the reading?
These verses are way, way down on my list. Okay, well, I'm going to then read you some things, and we'll talk about them. The first one, close your eyes. Put your death in your heart. This is the key for checking whether your practice is tuned too tight or too loose. How many of you saw the Little Buddha movie? 1, 2, 3, 4. Four. Okay. Well, you guys can close your ears or go take a nap or something. Little Buddha was made by Bertolucci, the Italian director. And it's about a young American white boy who was recognized as the reincarnation of a lama, I think in Bhutan, who had died. They put out a search party and found him in Seattle, of all places. And they approach his parents, you know, well, he's the special kid. He's just our son, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they want to take him to Bhutan to go through the tests to make sure that he's the reincarnation. So they agree for that. His father is not working, what, because a good friend of his was killed or something? Any of you remember why? I don't know, but he was kind of depressed, the father was. And so anyway, the father and son go to go to Bhutan to start this process. But the movie, the lama who's doing the search, it was his teacher that died, meditates, and he meditates on the life of the Buddha and things like that. But the meditations that he goes through are shown in visual things. They're taking the airplane to Bhutan, and the kid's wide awake, you know, and everybody else on the plane is sleeping. And the lama's sitting there meditating, and the boy gets in the seat in front and just looks back. And finally, the lama opens his eyes. The boy says, "What were you doing?" "I was meditating." "On what?" And he starts talking about how things are like clouds, you know, they aren't really there, and there's clouds going by the window. The movie's just like that. And I'm telling you the story because yes, too tight and too loose. And they get to Bhutan, and it turns out that there are two other candidates for the reincarnation. One is a very stuck-up girl, young girl, 11-year-old, something like that, in India. And another one is a little tiny street urchin in Kathmandu. And the kids finally meet each other. And the story, the life story of the Buddha is told during this scene. And Keanu Reeves plays the young Buddha before he's enlightened, while he's still a prince. And they go through that story that you see in the paintings about Lord Buddha's early life. And how he decides to seek enlightenment. He doesn't know that's what he's going to do, but does that. And they show him, his parents kept him from outside. Everything in the palace was all he was allowed to see. It's perfect. No suffering. They didn't want any of that for him. So finally, he has to go outside in some form or other for some ceremony. And so the palace staff goes out and makes sure that all the poor people are cleaned away, that the storefronts look nice, they're painted, there's jewels there, the elephants that are carrying him are there, that there's nothing that would disturb him. But he sees a poor beggar and wants to know what's wrong. And the beggar can't talk. But it's the first suffering the Lord Buddha has seen. There are two other things that happened to him. And he decides there's something wrong here. And he leaves the palace and gets hooked up with five ascetics that he's going to meditate with. And the ascetics are demonstrating five ways of personal deprivation. One's got something on his tongue, a big weight, and his tongue's always out, so it hangs down to here, you know. Another guy has something in his ears, somebody in his nose. I mean, they're really making themselves suffer to get renunciation. That's something we don't do. In fact, it's against a bodhisattva vow to punish yourself like that. But Lord Buddha decides that's what he's going to do, and he spends time with them. A couple of years, and he realizes he's not making any progress. He doesn't think he's meditating right. He's meditating on nothing, which is a wrong thing to do. But he realizes that. But he's talking to somebody, and there's somebody in a boat, a canoe, going down the river, playing a guitar, and the guitar's out of strain, and they'll tune it up a little bit better. And Gautama goes, "That's it. You know, if the string is too tight, it'll break. If it's too loose, it won't play," meaning the guitar string. And that was the middle way. the extremes do not work. The extreme he was doing of total deprivation, physical deprivation, wasn't going to do it for him. And he already knew the palace life didn't do it for him either. So that set him off on the path to enlightenment. So that's what this is. Too loose, too tight. Doesn't work. It's a reference for that. The story's in a sutra somewhere. Okay. Basically, it says, put your death in your heart. Ask yourself, you know, would I be doing what I'm doing right now if I knew I was going to die an hour from now? So spend your day thinking about this. Is what I'm doing what I ought to be doing right now if I'm going to die an hour from now? That's a good way to check up on whether your practice is good or not. You know, are you working too hard at your job, not doing anything else? Or are you just sort of slacking off and not doing anything else? Am I really helping people or am I not? Am I more concerned for myself? So that's the analogy of tuning the guitar string. Don't make it too tight, don't make it too loose. Just do the right thing. The next verse is, think of the viper's nest of the problems of this life. This is the key to stopping attachment at the bottom of your heart. So think of what you have now. You know, you have got a job maybe, got a family, a car, a bank account maybe, friends, special friends, house, wine cellar. This is for people that aren't Buddhist yet. Clothes, shoes, whatever. All of those things will be ripped away from you when you die. They're not going to help you at all. The only thing that'll be left when you die is your knowledge. Mainly knowledge, Dharma. That's the only thing that's going to help. So don't be attached to all the things you have now. It's not going to do you any good. They're absolutely worthless in the long run. It's okay to have them, but don't be attached to them.
And also not to be attached to people who are near to me.
Say again.
Does this mean also not to be attached to people, to human beings?
It does. Right. Yeah, if you are attached to, well, I mean, the typical thing is love, you know. Love these days is really attachment. There's a song I love to quote whenever we do this in class. It was popular in America, I don't know, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, 70s maybe. I can't live if living is without you. I can't do this, you know. I can't do anything if you're not around. You have to make me happy. And that is not love. That's attachment. Yeah.
But does it also mean, because, so, for example, if I'm a mother and I love my child, so I think for me it's very hard to see it in a. I know there is an attachment, you know,
yeah,
from my side, but I also have mother feelings, so it's very difficult for me, or I love my mother too. Yeah, how can I differentiate?
You cannot depend upon them for your happiness. They will let you down. But you must take care of them, right? It's your job as a mother to take care, to educate, to train your daughter. And it's your job to love your mother too. But you cannot depend on them. A good friend of mine, when I first went to Italy, I went back, she was a student of Lama Zopa's. And I hadn't seen her for a couple of years. And I was back for Christmas, I think, and gave her a holler. He goes, you know, I'm back in town. Is it okay if I come see you? It was Christmas Eve, right? She said, yes, come on over, you know. But she told me, you know, during the 2 years that I hadn't seen her, both of her children had turned against her in really ugly ways. Her husband had had a heart attack, a serious one. He was okay now. Her world had fallen apart. And she told me, you know, she hadn't seen Lama Zopa for a while and went to her and he said, how have you been? And she told him. And he said, boy, you've really had a rough time. And Lama Zopa's a traditional Tibetan Lama. You don't touch him, anything like that. He took her in his arms and just held her, you know. And when she stopped crying, he said, what did you learn from this? And she said, I learned that you can't have attachment to family and you can't have attachment to lovers, you know. He said, that's pretty good. And that's it, you know. You can't depend on your family for anything. You can't depend on your friends. You can't depend on money. You can't depend on food or anything else. They will let you down. That's the jitan part, the basis for rot, you know, for destruction. It doesn't mean you don't love them. You know, but this love business, I will do anything I can to make you happy. That's the love part. It isn't, I'm not happy if you're not around. It's not that. My mother was great on guilt trips. She would not let me out of her sight. And when I got into Boy Scouts and it was time to go on a weekend camping trip, I'm going to worry every minute you're gone, you know. What am I supposed to do with that? And she never got over it. One day, I said, all right, here's what I'm going to do. And I told her all the dangerous things I'm going to do. So this is what you can worry about. You better worry about it a lot. Didn't do any good. And that's attachment too, you know. But the love part is just give. I give anything I can, anything I can do is what I will do. and you're not attached to that, right? And that's the kind of thing that leads you to enlightenment. Okay. The viper's nest of the problems in this life, the viper's nest is samsara, right? Geshe-la had come upon the term vicious cycle to describe samsara for this teaching. He said, that's really good. It's a vicious cycle. Why is it vicious? Because everything that we do keeps us in samsara. Everything we do to make us happy keeps us in samsara. And we never think of doing things for other people.
The German word for that is devil's circle.
Devil's circle would be good, yeah. Yeah. Devil's really good, you know. People ever so often ask me, do you guys believe in demons? And of course we do. What do they look like? They're our mental afflictions. They're the things that keep us in samsara. And they are ugly, vicious, et cetera, et cetera. Except for the imps that are kind of cute, they keep putting their fingers on my glasses. They're a nuisance, but, well, never mind. So if we keep our mind on what samsara is like, we will then not become attached to anything in this life. If we understand that anything around us will let us down, including our bodies, you know, our bodies will let us down in the end. They'll die, and that's it. We're done. Our mind, subtle minds continue, but that's it. So we can't become attached to our bodies either. Going to the gym for 3 hours a day is a waste of time. And that's self-cherishing. You know, taking a walk, enough to keep your body healthy is fine, but no more than that. I mean, you have to keep the body going as long as you can. You know, Geshe-la talks about Ken Rinpoche learning how to control his diabetes, how much insulin he needed for this and for that. You know, he had a table. He kept getting new eyeglasses and learning how to keep his vision going. He wanted to keep the machine running for as long as he possibly could. But that was it. He knew it was going to let him down. It was just a matter of maintenance now. And no more than that. And that was for the benefit of his students. So that's what we have to learn to do. Next part, close your eyes. Let every thought be of what others need. This is the key for making everything you ever do the Dharma. And basically, it doesn't matter what you do if you have the welfare of others in mind at all times. And if you do that, then everything that you do becomes Dharma. So let's examine that a little bit more. What are we doing? We're training our minds and we're training our hearts to become loving and giving and everything else about the six perfections, always with others in mind. And so no matter what we do, if we're doing it for the benefit of others or even one particular person, which is what most of us are going to be doing at any given time, then that becomes Dharma for us. Why is it Dharma? Because it moves us closer to enlightenment. We are teaching ourselves how to behave. At this point in our life, all the teachings we've received have been about how to think and how to behave toward others in fairly simplistic ways. The thinking is not simplistic. I mean, you know, in our tradition, thinking is crucial. We have to understand emptiness, for example, and understand the basic laws of karma. But now we're taking what we've learned and are teaching ourselves how to go to the next level, how to go to the next step. The result of all of this is going to be a direct perception of emptiness. So we have to do that. As we're doing our practice from this point on, keeping others in mind, we're generating very powerful karma. And that will take us more and more quickly to a direct perception of emptiness. I guess this is a good time to talk about the third step of the path of preparation, which we learned about in Mexico. There are five, we call them paths in the Dharma. First one is a path of accumulation, where you generate karma to be able to practice more. The second one is called the path of preparation. The third is called the path of seeing, which is a direct perception of emptiness, where you directly, without conceptual thought, but directly perceive reality. Meaning that nothing has any nature of its own. You see that directly, you understand it directly. All right? And that lasts 24 hours, roughly. And then you're on the path of familiarization, where you spend your time familiarizing yourself with the experience on the on your direct perception of emptiness. You may have more direct perceptions of emptiness, but you can do it with your conceptual mind as well. What you were doing at that point is removing your mental afflictions. You're burning them away with wisdom. And then you'll reach nirvana, and that may be your endpoint if you just want freedom from suffering for yourself, or you'll reach, it's still nirvana if you're on the bodhisattva path, but you're now on the seventh bodhisattva ground, and you spend 7, 8, 9, and 10 removing obstacles to omniscience. And when those are gone, you are a Buddha. It happens like that. I mean, from non-Buddha to Buddha is like that. It's not a gradual thing. But the removing the obstacles, you can do it in this lifetime. In fact, you can do the whole path in this lifetime. And we're sort of preparing you for that. You do it with Tantra. But you've got to be ready. Tantra is dangerous otherwise. Okay, so on the path of preparation, I had been taught that the path of preparation begins when you have an intellectual understanding of emptiness. It's like an aha, just boink. Things fall into place regarding emptiness. And the reaction of somebody that does that is usually they just break out laughing. This is so damn easy. Why didn't I do it before, you know, kind of thing. But Geshe-la went deeper with that for us. The understanding when you reach the path of preparation, the first level, is an intellectual, clear understanding of the four truths of Aryas. This life is composed of suffering. That there is a cause for the suffering. If there's a cause for the suffering, there's a cause for removing the suffering. And there's a path to be able to do this. That was the first thing Lord Buddha taught after he became enlightened on this planet. He was already enlightened when he got here, but he did that for us. So you have a clear intellectual understanding of the four truths of Aryas. Clear meaning it probably won't get any clearer conceptually for you. That's the first level. The second level is that you gain a kind of fuzzy understanding of the emptiness of things. It's got to be self. I don't remember. Self, I think. And that's okay. That's pretty good. The third level of the path of preparation is that you gain a clear understanding of the emptiness of self and a fuzzy understanding of the emptiness of things. Emptiness of things is what isn't yourself. And at this point, your hand could be things. All right. When you reach that level, you will never, ever again be forced to take rebirth in the lower realms. Even before you have a direct perception of emptiness, you can be confident that you won't fall into the lower realms, the hell realms, the hungry ghost, and the animal realm. And it also probably means that you won't waste your time in the god realms either. So you'll have human rebirths. And that's really an amazing thing, you know. And then you've got more of the path of preparation to go before you have a direct perception of emptiness. But you never again worry about the hell realms. So that's something to think about. Close your eyes. Don't think of anything but your lama. This is the key for turning your mind and theirs into one. So this is a statement about guru yoga. In guru yoga, you bring your lama into you, literally. It's their mind you're bringing in, and make them one. And there's practices to do this. In fact, when you're doing your meditation, when you get to that point, you'll start your meditation with bringing your lama into you. And then you do the meditation. And since you've brought your lama's mind into you, you have his mind working or her mind working for you too. And that's how you make progress, quickly. So it says, don't think of anything except your lama. You know, imagine what the mind of your lama is like. You do that in a little, in a partial way when you start off your meditation with prostrating to your lama. What about your lama do you want for yourself? What quality? Okay. But when you bring your lama into you, just imagine you're bringing their entire mind into you. You bring your lama to the top of your head. He's now tiny, about like so. And then he turns into light, or you can make him really, really, really tiny. And he comes into the central channel at the top of your head, and sort of like riding the elevator, comes down the central channel and into your heart. And in your heart, you have a really nice, like a rose that's opened up. And inside the rose is a throne and cushion for your lama and everything they want, you know, orange juice, whatever it is. And the rose then kind of encloses your lama. And then bright light comes out and fills your entire body. That's a good meditation to do. You're bringing your lama into yourself. And that's called guru yoga. And it becomes a major practice in the tantric practice. So it says, this is the key for turning your mind and their mind into one thing. And that's what your lama is trying to get you to do. You know, your lama will yell at you sometimes. They'll do horrible things to you for your benefit. And it works. You know, you think, what does my lama want me to do right now? And that's also a practice. We learned it in the tantric series, how to behave towards your lama. In the FPMT, those teachings are kind of open, how to behave around your lama. But you do things like that. You take care of it. You bring your lama into you. You think, all right, what does my lama want me to do right now? and you begin thinking about that. The program director in Italy, we were talking, and she'd have questions about the program, you know, and write them down and then go see Geshe Jampa Gyatso, who was her lama. He was our teacher. And get an answer and come back. And then she told me that she'd had about a week where she'd write down the questions. She'd think about them and just didn't know what to do. So she'd take them to Geshe La. She would walk into his house and know the answer. And would go check it out. Yeah, that was it. Then eventually she didn't have to do that anymore. She just was my, what's the right thing to do here? What would he have me do? And she'd just know, and you wouldn't have to go ask him. But it's something that you do, you learn how to do. Why do we have lamas? You pick somebody, first of all, who knows more than you do. And you have to consider your lama as a Buddha. You want to reach enlightenment. The only people who can tell you how to reach enlightenment are those who have done it. And those are Buddhas. And Lord Buddha said, somebody asked him one day, what are we going to do when you leave? You know, we won't have a teacher. And he said, we've had this in a course. He said, I will appear in the body of your teacher. That will be me. So we consider our lamas, even if we have more than one, Buddhas. Okay, they are enlightened. If they aren't, big deal. They're not going to take it to enlightenment. Which doesn't mean that you can't find somebody that you think has really good bodhicitta and go to them to develop really good bodhicitta. Which is what Lord Atisha did. Atisha, sorry. Well, he went to Sumatra on a horrible boat ride because he, in asking around, decided that the best teacher for bodhicitta was a lama named Serlingpa in Sumatra. And he spent 12 years with him. And it was while he was in Sumatra that he got the invitation to go up to Tibet. And had to ask Serlingpa's permission to do that. He said, okay, but you have to write an important text on bodhicitta. How to get there. And Lord Atisha said, okay, you know, and that was the first Lamrim. Written in both Sanskrit and Tibetan. So it is in both the Tengyur and the Kangyur, Sungbum collections in Tibet. Written in both Sanskrit and Tibetan without translation. He did both of them himself. Mm-hmm. Close your eyes. See the world and people as angels. This is the key for stopping the idea that life is ordinary. So if you practice daily and do these practices daily, your life will become a paradise. It has to. You learn to view other people as better than you, higher than you is a better way to put it. All right? They are more important than you are. And then you view them as angels. You know, we talked about that according to scripture, there's got to be a few Buddhas sprinkled in here somewhere or other. But they're all around us, all the time. So we learn to see everybody that way. We don't know which one it is, so why not make them all angels, you know? Make them all Buddhas. And when you do that, if that becomes your practice, then you're in heaven. It's quite simple. Now, Jesus is talking about the kingdom of heaven someplace. And toward the end of it, he says, there are a few of you here who will see the kingdom of heaven before you die. And this is what he's talking about. You will understand. Your practice will become such that even the centurions in the Roman army will be angels for you. And that's, you know, what he was doing. You know, trying to save Israel from destruction by the army. He failed. But he did get a few people to understand. And that's why we practice this. We're changing our minds. If somebody, a slave in Israel, could change their mind to be able to see the centurions as angels, that's an amazing thing. The efforts of the black churches in slavery in America were doing that same thing. They were using the Book of Revelation a lot, but they were transforming their minds to make sure that they could ease their own suffering. I don't know that they knew what they were doing in terms of karma, but they did it. It worked. You can tell from their music. It's quite obvious. And you will be able to tell when this starts to happen to you. I don't want a new album. How did I get here? Close your eyes. Whatever comes, make it crystal. This is the key for making this life turn into freedom, all by itself. So this is about understanding that all things are empty, that they have no nature of their own. You make them crystal. The pen, understanding it is empty, makes it like it's transparent. It doesn't look that way, but it's like that. You know, it's clear, it's unblemished, like a diamond, you know, things like that. So when you can do that, when you train yourself to understand that all things are empty, even though they don't appear to use that way, and you do that simply by keeping your vows, well, your bodhisattva vows in this case. And then that will basically free you from samsara, meaning that it will get you into direct perception of emptiness and then the removal of all your mental afflictions. At that point, you're out of samsara. When you reach the seventh bodhisattva ground on the bodhisattva path, you're out of samsara. You still have a body, but you can control your rebirths. You know, before you have a direct perception of emptiness, at that third level of the path of preparation, you no longer are forced into a lower rebirth. You can choose to go to the hell, the hell beings there. That's a myth. No bodhisattva is going to do that. They're going to keep working, right? To reach enlightenment, and then they can go to hell. That's okay. But that's what this is about. See things clearly. Understand that things don't come from their own side. Understand that our projections are incorrect in that we think that things do come from their own side. but we understand it differently. And then that generates our Buddha paradise, or in Christian terms, heaven. That's what it's about. Going to these Lamrim retreats is like going to heaven. I'm there 2-3 days, knowing what's going to happen, and it always happens. It used to be Thursdays, now it's Wednesdays. It's moving up. Try to get to one of these. It isn't just the teachings, although it's a big part of it, but the people, you would be there with people like yourself, except there's 120, you know, from all over the world, doing the same thing, having the same realizations. It's magic. It's just plain magic. Okay. So now, that was the six keys. These aren't the six keys. I don't know what happened here. Oh, here it is. All right, well, we'll go to the five poisons. Say duchak.
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 Duchak. Duchak. Du means asserting, maybe. When you're in debate, somebody goes blah, 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 and you say duh, maybe, or teacher, or whatever. Duh means, yeah, I accept, I assert that, right? But here, and the chak part is having desire and asserting that that's okay. But it means liking things ignorantly, not understanding that if you like them, it's not the object that's giving you the liking or the happiness. It's your karma. So one of the poisons is liking things ignorantly. In the wheel of life in the middle, you see what? A pig?
A rooster
and a snake. The rooster used to be a pigeon. Pigeons are, in an English word, randy.
Ulrike? Randy?
Yeah. It's an British English term. Randy Andy is Prince Andrew, who liked women, right? All the time. We had pigeons in Italy. The farmhouse we were in had thick stone walls, and they had put little holes in them. I'm not sure what for, maybe for pigeons, but the pigeons would go in there and nest. There was room for maybe one or two, and that was it. And they would have babies. And when Lama Zopa was looking at the place and decided, yeah, this would be good, it needed to be fixed up, and people said, okay, we'll put plaster in the walls and fill up these holes. And he said, don't fill up the holes. You know, these are for the pigeons. But the pigeons on the ground, some of us go out after lunch with some bread and just throw it. You have 200 pigeons around you. And there were always 10 males chasing females. They'd rather do that than eat. You know, so pigeons are a good example of ignorant, just liking, right? Grasping, desire, that kind of thing. So if you want to have every happiness, you must use the antidote that keeps you from liking things ignorantly. That should be keeps instead of keep. You must use the antidotes. Okay, the keep is proper. We have strange plural and singular rules in English, at least as far as spelling goes. All right, so the measure of whether you like things intelligently or ignorantly is, Roger said this several times in the last two, three classes.
If you think if the happiness comes from the things, or if you would do bad things to get them.
Right. If I would harm somebody, even a little bit, to get what I want, that's ignorant liking. Because you think that the happiness is coming from the thing. So ignorance means that you don't know really where the thing is coming from, that you haven't thought about it. Or it could also be that, you know, your boss is yelling at you and all of a sudden they're self-existent and you don't like it. That's the next one. And you might shove your boss, you know, to get away from that. So, if I'm in the office and it's 10 o'clock, no, make it 2 o'clock in the afternoon, make it 3 o'clock. Timing's very important here.
Zombie hour.
And I go into the break room for an espresso, and I see a piece of chocolate cake on the table, and I, oh yeah, right, you know. And I go to take it. My going to take it means I haven't thought about where it really comes from. And then I do. If I want the piece of chocolate cake, what's the best thing I can do with it?
Share.
Mm-hmm. Offer it to somebody else. It's okay to split it. And so on. That's the intelligent thing to do. That's liking it intelligently. You know where it comes from. It comes from giving other people chocolate cake in the past. And it may not be chocolate cake, something like, right? I mean, you wouldn't give chocolate cake to somebody that hates chocolate and get good karma. Or get a piece of chocolate cake for that. You would get, if you offered a piece of chocolate cake to somebody who hates chocolate, you would be offered something you can't stand in the future. Like whale blubber. Or whatever. Chocolate covered grasshopper. All right. The next one is what?
Ignorant disliking.
Right. If you want to free yourself from all pain, you must use the antidotes that keep you from disliking things ignorantly. Again, the ignorant part is not understanding where the thing comes from. If you don't like it, it's because you've given somebody something they don't like in the past. And maybe forced them to eat it. Or use it or whatever. It doesn't have to be food, you know. Could be forcing somebody to have a bad job, and you're forced to have a bad job. And the measure is, if you would hurt somebody to keep the thing you don't like away from you, that's ignorant disliking. That thing doesn't come from them. It comes from you. Having done something similar in the past. When you manage to control ignorant disliking for a while, all of your pain will disappear. Question is, how long is a while? It could be a lifetime. It could be a few weeks. You know, it depends on your level of practice, where you are. And if it turns out to be a few weeks, don't be surprised. And if it turns out not to happen, don't be surprised either. you have to trust the karma. You have to trust the teachings, which is part of drawing the line. You know, if you don't get the results you want right away, keep on doing them. You've got to trust what's going to happen. And a good way to build that trust is just start doing little things and watching. Keep track of what's going on around you. The third of the five poisons. Yes.
Ignorance itself. Ignorance. The pick.
Just a question to number two. Is there a way to dislike things intelligently?
Yeah. I mean, you may not like quail blubber. That's my example. I like almost everything, right? Except I think quail blubber, maybe no. I have no idea. But yeah, it doesn't taste good. Or you go to a restaurant and the food's terrible. It's okay to not like it. But understand that's because you prepared lousy food for other people.
Doesn't mean to dislike mental affliction, for example.
Disliking mental, well, you can hate mental afflictions.
That's not an intelligent way to.
Yeah. And I mean, if you know that it's a mental affliction to begin with, you're past the ignorance point. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's okay to be angry at your mental afflictions. That's probably healthy. It'll make you do something. Okay, if you want to reach matchless enlightenment, you must use the antidotes that keep you from being ignorant. No big deal there, right? Ignorance is not knowing how the world works. Meaning you don't know anything about karma or emptiness. Or you haven't put it into practice. No. You can learn about things. You can give good answers on your homework. But if you don't practice them, they're not going to do anything for you at all. It won't change your mind, for example. You got to start doing them, living by them. Which is, again, part of this drawing the line in the sand. You know, this is where I stand on this. Haven't got the results. Don't care. This is what I'm going to do. Okay. When you conquer ignorance, you gain
wisdom.
Further.
Enlightenment.
Remember on the Bodhisattva path, you finish the six perfections, the last one being wisdom. You're now out of samsara, you're in nirvana. But you aren't done, right? And you keep on going. The last thing to fall is the last knowledge obstruction, which would be a part of ignorance. And when that goes, Buddhahood, right there. I didn't give you the result of getting rid of ignorant liking. What do you think it is?
Ignorant liking.
Abundance.
Oh, well, that could be.
Happiness.
Happiness. Yeah. You get rid of ignorant disliking, you're free from pain. You get rid of ignorant liking, you are happy. You get rid of ignorance itself, you're enlightened. Isn't that all there is? Apparently not. Pride. Saying Nagyal. 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 It means
pride.
Well, it does mean pride. What's the literal meaning of Nagyal?
King?
There's a king in there.
King, yeah.
What's a na part?
No, I.
I came. That's the literal, yeah, literal translation of Nagil. I came. Yeah, which the Tibetans interpret as pride. If you want to stand independent on your own, you must use the antidotes that keep you from feeling any pride. How do those things link together? Stand on your own and having pride. Do you think?
If you have pride, you always need others to feed it, to tell you how great you are, or you depend on them for your happiness.
Yes, that's good.
You're very dependent on this I.
Yeah, that's true too.
To stand independent on your own is also the self-confidence, so the good pride.
Oh, right. We'll get to good pride in a minute. Yeah.
I think that is independent on your own.
It's so nice teaching here. And, you know, in the open courses when we cover pride, it's always the bad pride. Because what I'm going to tell you about the good pride is tantric. But you're going to hear about it anyway. And it's nice to be able to do that. And I think it's necessary, too. Pride typically means putting other people down. You know? And if you do, if that's what keeps you propped up, then you're not independent. You know, and the answers that everybody gave before are all part of that, right? It's fake. Your independence in thinking, your independence to stand alone, of being able to keep on the side of the line you just drew in the sand, is flimsy. It won't last. It cannot last. So in this respect, pride is a poison. It's not included in the wheel of life in the middle, but it's certainly a poison, especially when we get to the higher teachings. The wheel of life was basically meant for people in the lower track, the Hinayana track, people that just want out of samsara. You can reach nirvana and still have some self-cherishing. Because you don't need to put others first if your goal is nirvana. You do a little bit, but it isn't the key thing you do. You can still have self-cherishing a little bit and reach nirvana. Pride obliterates that. You cannot, when you're going for enlightenment, you cannot make progress if you have this bad pride. I can. There are 9 kinds of pride, which we cover in course something or other. If you've covered them already, I'm sure you've forgotten them. And if you haven't, you don't know them. So you're all the same in that. Oh, Rongo Tungpa we had up here. We didn't. Well, that's a Tibetan term anyway. Rongo Tungpa is to stand independent. This is where I am. It doesn't make any difference what other people think. This is where I am. You know. Now, the good pride, Nagil, same word, same spelling, but in the higher teachings, it has to do with what we call divine pride. Meaning, you imagine you're a deity, and this is what I can do. I can control my negative emotions. I can love other people no matter what. I can do that, and that's divine pride. I am Yamataka. who you'll meet later next weekend. You know, I am Vajrayogini. I am Tara. And that's good stuff. Somebody was talking, His Holiness was talking about ego once, and some student asked him about getting, don't we have to get rid of ego? And isn't that what keeps us in trouble? And he said, well, yeah, you know, you have to tame it. But you know, you think about it. You take bodhisattva vows. I will be responsible for the enlightenment of everybody else in the universe, even if I have to do it by myself alone. And he said, you've got to have a little bit of ego to be able to put yourself in that spot. Like, this is who I am. You know, think of Jesus. The Father and I are one. That's a statement of identity. And it isn't a little kind of shrinking violent sort of thing. That's who I am. And you can be that too. Why does the keyboard keep showing up? The next one?
Jealousy.
You must be looking at your notes.
Yes.
If you want to stop all obstacles, you must use the antidotes that keep you from feeling jealousy. Not feeling jealous, but feeling jealousy. Right. I don't know what the difference is between those two, but Geshe-la seemed to think there was. So, you know, jealousy is a state of mind that cannot stand to see somebody else get what they want. That's a sick state of mind. You know, especially for a bodhisattva. You want to make others happy. And now you have this mental affliction that cannot stand to see anybody else be happy. Especially if they get what they want. So that's a poison. You know, that poison is as strong as any of the others. And maybe even worse. And it consumes you when it happens. Pride does too. We all know about ignorant liking and disliking and anger and stuff like that. But we get to these others, and in many ways they're even worse, probably because they're more subtle and harder to recognize. But the damage they do is just as strong as anything else. So we have to work against that. When you conquer jealousy, you stop all obstacles in your life. They simply disappear. Think why that might be true.
Because you're happy for other people not to have obstacles in their lives and to get everything they want. You're happy. So you're not having any obstacles yourself.
Well, that's good.
Because then your seats will help you get whatever you want. So no obstacles. Yeah.
Perfection of giving if I'm happy for others?
Things sort of intertwine here, don't they? You know, we talk about the six perfections and how on the bodhisattva path you do giving and then you do
ethical living.
Mm-hmm.
Joyful effort. Patience, concentration, and wisdom.
Okay. In fact, you do all those simultaneously. You perfect them in those order on the path of familiarization, right? But while you're going up there, and even while you're doing it, you use all six at the same time. If you're working on giving, you can do that by paying attention to your morality. You can use it to stop anger. It's interesting. When you have a direct perception of emptiness, that doesn't stop anger. You still got to work on it. But it's much, much, much reduced. And you can get rid of it even before path of seeing. Easy to do. Well, it's easy to do. It's painful, but it's easy to do. You can practice giving with joyful effort. You know, yeah, this is really, I really enjoy giving, you know. You can do it with concentration, and you can do it with wisdom. You have to do it with wisdom. And the same for the other five. You practice them simultaneously. Because that's really the only way that it works. So, did I tell you what happens when you conquer pride? I didn't. When you conquer pride, then you don't have to depend on anybody else for how you feel, for what you think. You don't have to depend on anybody else for your morality. Or your wisdom. It becomes yours. And yours alone. Okay. Do we have anything else here? Apparently we do.
Can I ask a question?
You may.
There was almost some pieces of paper. It always said the antidote. You must do the antidote for. Can we go through the five antidotes specifically? I know the antidote for pride is serving others, because it doesn't say what the antidotes are.
Yeah. The antidote to ignorant liking and disliking is understanding emptiness.
Yes.
Yep. Really. But in the context of when ignorant liking comes up, in the context of when ignorant disliking comes up, you have to analyze that. And it'll become easier to do. And the antidote to plain ignorance is understanding emptiness. It doesn't need to be a direct perception of emptiness, as we found out.
And the antidote to pride is serving others.
Yeah, that's good. And for jealousy,
it's helping others get what they want.
I think that would be good.
I'm keen on antidotes. I want to stock up my medical cabinet.
I have your bottles of stuff,
yes,
you know.
I want my rescue remedies.
It'd be nice if that was that simple. But it becomes that simple after a while. Yeah. Okay. This is another addition to something here. Oh, we're still with Gyalwa Yang Gunpa. I think this is a different teaching of his, and this is a short one. The reality of things is beyond the mind. So reside in a state where you hold to nothing. This sounds very Dzogchen-ish, which for me, I have no idea what they're talking about. So what does it mean, really? This is an example of how a teacher guides their students in his or hers deeper and deeper understandings of Dharma, you know, and then summarizes something in a sentence that seems very weird to people that haven't had that training. That's an ununderstandable sentence too. You're riding to Salzburg with a couple, three other students, and your lama. And your lama is telling you things. And what your lama is telling you, typically on rides like that, is he's kind of summarizing the things that he's told you before in formal classes. And now he's got people, just a few people in the car, that he thinks can understand in a deeper way what he's about to say, that maybe the other students couldn't understand. He may give a different instruction to other students. But this is an example like that. The reality of things is beyond the mind. Meaning, emptiness is something you cannot perceive with your conceptual mind. True emptiness. You could have an intellectual understanding of it. And I think many of you do. But it's not a direct perception. The direct perception is beyond the mind, the mind being the conceptual mind here. And that cannot be described. It can only be experienced. So reside in a state where you hold to nothing. Meaning, what?
Emptiness. Oh, non-grasping.
Yeah, no grasping. Not self-existent. Not self-existent.
Not self-existent.
Not self-existent. You grasp to nothing.
Isn't it also you understand the emptiness of the emptiness of all things?
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Yeah. I would guess.
It's nothing.
Yeah, emptiness is empty too.
Or the understanding I have in the moment so that I always can improve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Did you hear that? Whatever understanding of emptiness you have right now, it's going to get deeper. Because it's empty. It can change. When we were studying Abhisamyamkara, there's a section where they go through four increasingly subtle understanding of emptiness. Or in this case, it was selflessness, I think. But you get down to the fourth level, and that's what emptiness or selflessness is. And you've thought about it, we've discussed it in class there and everything else. Yeah, that's it. And then the next line, that's not true either. It isn't it. Yeah, you can't grasp to anything as being self-existent. Meaning, in this case, that state was true for the sun side. Nope. Okay. So where are we? You know, a lot of Western students, I'm going to put students in parentheses, you know, who simply read Dharma texts and don't have a teacher, will read a sentence like this, you know, the reality of things is beyond the mind, so reside in a state where you hold to nothing. is, oh, wow, I don't have to think of anything. Nothing exists anyway. So just float on nothingness. And such ideas are poison themselves to Dharma study. They'll take you quickly to the hell realms because you won't have to pay attention to your morality or anything else. You know, it's very, very dangerous. When you see people doing things like this, do your best kindly and lovingly to correct them. I'm finding out one of the best things to do is just say, why or what? Explain that carefully, please. I have a new, three new housemates in my house. And there's a young man, just graduated college, who's in the arts, ceramics, actually, that was his major. But he's running the 3D printer, and he's really, really smart and really, really nice. And kind of shy, I think, too. And then there's a man who works basically as a busboy at two different restaurants in Sedona. He's got a daughter, grown, a really nice young woman. But he said, I don't have any, he didn't say attached as a hindrances, maybe, you know. He's divorced, no girlfriend, he's free that way. And I think it's kind of freeing for him. And he's a really nice guy, too. And there's a woman who's 60-ish, is my guess. And I've discovered she is afraid of everything in the world. She latches onto conspiracy theories, things that are going to hurt her. Coleman, the young guy, was programming the microwave to heat some food. And she saw him doing that. She ran out of the room and said, I can't be in the room when this is going on. You know, fortunately for him, okay, didn't make any difference, but that's the way she is. She's with a group of people who love these, I don't know, rapture kind of things. She's in a church group. It meets the Jewish Community Center, and I can't figure out whether it's Jewish-based or Christian-based. It's neither, frankly, but they have these... No, there are these people out there waiting to help us on the other side and stuff like that. And it's going to happen soon. How do you know that? Oh, it is. It's unexamined. And it's there. She needs to be protected. She can't bear anything, and it all has to do with stuff that's been fed to her that isn't true. And she latches onto it as being true. And it's hard to know how to help somebody like that. But I've just said, why? Why is that true? Who told you that? Who told them that? You know, and she has no answers, and she just sort of shuts up and goes away, rather than think about it. She's a nice woman as far as I can tell. But man, she's headed for the hell realms. It's the example of not using your brain, you know, consciously not using your brain. And that's not a good thing. So I'm trying to figure out what to do about that. And I'm pretty much at the point now there isn't anything I can do about it. You know, just sort of be there for her. And question, why is that true? You know, okay. Gyalwa Yong Gunpo carefully trained his students, and then he would give them these little, you know, personal advices kinds of things. His students and he analyzed scripture the way that we do in the ACI courses. You know, we get scripture. What does it mean? No, what's the point of this? Why does karma work? What happens in karma? What does emptiness really mean? What's the emptiness of the self? You know, how do the Bodhisattva vows work? And things like that. Plus the logic class. He taught his students how to meditate the way we do. He taught his students how to debate. And at that point, in the Tagyu tradition, debate was strong, like it is in Gelugpa today. I mean, the debate tradition in Kagyu became the debate tradition in Gelugpa after Jeitsongkhapa. So they had the basics. They were thoroughly trained. And then he would push his students just a little, well, quite a bit further ahead with a simple statement that he knew they could understand, but hadn't yet come up for themselves. And that's what these kinds of teachings are, you know. Specialized, personalized instruction. So after many years in the classroom with his students, you know, in the car to Salzburg, he'd say something like this. And they go, ah, like that, right, got it. And that was what Geshe-la did to a lot of us with his teaching on, we won't go to the hell realms again. Something we should have known, and probably could have figured out. but he just took the time to say, this is the way it is. Are we done? We are. Any questions? Any more questions? Okay. Tomorrow, when do we start tomorrow?
Okay.
That's when we start, right? What do we start? Oh, ho, ho, ho. Tomorrow we do the seven-step practice, which is probably the most famous Lojong. We have the most famous Lojong, we have the best Lojong, we have, I don't know, whichever Geshe-la teaches, that's the best one. and he's right, of course. But the seventh step is a very famous one. And, we'll spend both classes tomorrow on it. Who's doing this?
We missed it in the beginning.
We missed it in the beginning.
Sashi Pukki Jukshin Meto Tram Rira Lingshi Inde Gimpari Sanye Shindu Mikte Urvarvi Gokun Namdak Shingla Chupasho Idam Guru Ratna Mandala Kamiryatayami Geva Dihi Gevo Kum Sunam Yeshe Tokto Shin Sunam Yeshe Lejun Wei Dhamma Kuni Topa Shor